Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 312. We're featuring Habib Zargarpour, head of film development at Digital Monarch Media, which is a subsidiary of Unity 3D. What, pretty cool. Habib is, shall we say, a veteran of the industry. He has been around for a long time, right, Kristen?
Mm-hmm. Very, very long.
Yeah, yeah. What were some of the cool things that you remembered about this podcast?
Well, I liked how the first Blade Runner is what inspired him, and then he got to work on the new Blade Runner, so that was awesome.
And we go on a deep, deep dive into Blade Runner. So if you if you're a Blade Runner 2049 fan, as I am, and really love Roger Deakins' stories, which would be even more incredible. So this is a really deep dive into that. It's awesome, awesome, awesome. Anyway, go ahead, keep going.
He's worked on like some heavy VFX projects, and like Perfect Storm and Star Wars
Twister.
One. Yes. But yeah. Perfect Storm was actually the name of our soccer team growing up because of that movie. So
really?
Yeah, I love that movie.
Excellent.
And then you guys talk about like at the very end, like about the pod racers going 800 miles an hour, but it's actually in the system it's going like that. That was interesting to me because I didn't know.
Yeah, yeah, there's an interesting problem for it's actually an interesting ray tracing problem or rendering problem because of a floating point precision errors that can happen. When you're traveling at 800 miles an hour, it's really hard to actually get rendering to be accurate. We learned this actually on Tron for the jets and the bikes because they're traveling at such high speed that you actually have precision problems, but it's solvable. We did it on Tron, et cetera. It's a really good exercise to find out how to do that. Anyway, really cool stuff. Really great talking to Habib. He's a really, like I said, really knowledgeable person. He has been doing this for a long time. He's won many accolades, BAFTAs, and nominated and won accolades, and really a fantastic person in that area. And really cool. We get into a deep dive into virtual production. Obviously, he has a big interest in virtual production that's going on there. Digital Monarch Studio is obviously involved with Unity in terms of understanding some of those things. So it was really great to have him on, and it was great. This was an introduction from Colin Green, who's been on the podcast before. So it was really nice to Colin to introduce us to Habib. So thank you so much, Colin, for doing this. It was a lot of fun having Habib on. Okay, we have an announcement. The announcement we have is that basically we are extending the Building Utopia competition by another month. We feel that we wanted to be able to give more people more opportunities. A lot of people didn't necessarily have the opportunity to work on the competition during the holidays. So we figured we'll give an extension for a month because that way the people have a little more time to get their work done or to enter the competition. So if you guys are interested in it, please go ahead and join in. It's buildingutopia.cgarchitect.com is the link. Again, that's buildingutopia.cgarchitect.com. And for those of you who don't know, it is a competition that we have created with our partners at Lenovo, NVIDIA, Kitbash 3D, and CG Architect. And it is about using Vantage. Vantage is our real-time ray tracer application. It's a standalone application which does fully real-time, fully ray traced. And you bring in your scene and you're able to do a lot of really cool stuff in Vantage, which we figured was mailed to a competition. So we partnered with all those guys. And the Kitbash 3D guys created a really amazing asset that you were doing, and then we're challenging you guys to create an animation inside of that asset. A lot of fun. Go check it out. Again, that's buildingutopia.cgarchitect.com. And if you want to check out Vantage, that is available as well, and it is free as of now. It is free, and it's available at chaoscoop.com to check out Vantage. All right, we have a couple of other items in the news. Kristen, what else is going on?
Yeah, so we have announced this already, but V-Ray 5 for Cinema 4D is out, and V-Ray 5 for Revit Beta is out as well.
That is correct. V-Ray 5 for Cinema 4D is very exciting. This is a lot of people have been using V-Ray for Cinema 4D, but this is V-Ray 5 for Cinema 4D, and this was entirely done by our team at Chaos Group before we used to license out V-Ray to another third party, and they would develop V-Ray for C4D, but we decided to take over the development of that area. So this is completely new. Lots of new stuff in V-Ray for C4D. Would love to have your feedback. It's a really big package, a really big news for us, so let us know. V-Ray 5 for C4D is out. And we would love to hear what you guys think about that. And of course, V-Ray 5 for Revit is also out, also very big for those of you in the architecture community. And we've done a lot of interesting things in this area, including a bunch of updates. So please let us know. Betas are always important for feedback. So thank you so much. V-Ray 5 for Revit and Beta. All of that is available at chaosgroup.com. Okay. If people want to know more about the podcast, Kristen, where can they go?
You can go to facebook.com/CG Garage Podcast or chaosgroup.com/CG Garage.
Perfect. And if you guys have any ideas of other things you want to do, like, you know, other guests, like, thank you, Colin, for letting us know about this one. Please email us. labs@chaosgroup.com is where you can email us. And that's where you get all the information about, all the different, you can tell us all about the different podcasts you like to have, as well as just give us feedback of this particular episode or any of our previous episodes or anything else you want to let us know about. And of course, you always get another good place to give us feedback is on Apple Podcast, which is a good place to share us as well. So give us a rating and a review there. And videos, as you guys know, for almost a year now, we've been doing this in video format, and they're available on our YouTube channel. That is Chaos Group TV is our YouTube channel that's available, as well as our Facebook page where we put all the videos up there as well. And that is facebook.com/CG Garage Podcast. And I think that's about it. Right, Kristen?
Yep.
Okay, looks perfect. Good. All right. So with that being said, please enjoy this awesome podcast with Habib Zarkapur.
Welcome to another CG Garage where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passé. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has for now.
Well, cool. Thank you so much. I'm so glad that that Colin suggested, you be on and talk about the really cool stuff that we're doing.
Thank you.
I'm very excited to talk to you. I've obviously been a huge fan of your work for many, many, many years. Obviously, you are a big, when the word veteran comes to mind, but you've been around for a long time in this area. I've been there for a long time, and not quite as much as a legend as your work has been.
Oh, it's been fun.
But
it's been
fun. I would love to know. I mean, everyone sort of has their origin stories, and they're all a little bit different. But what was some of the things, even in your youth, or things that inspired you to get into filmmaking and get into visual effects? And what sort of inspired you to get into the kind of things that you do?
A lot of people, of course, quote this same thing where they're like, the first time they saw Star Wars or,
right.
For me, Blade Runner as well. Yep. It's always impactful to when you experience films, and then it's like getting hit over the head with a bat, and you're like, wow, like what am I, what are all the things that went into what I just experienced? And then I had a combination of when I was like 13, I wanted to be a product designer, and anything artistic was like what I wanted to do. And I found out about industrial design watching TV in France, and Luigi Colani was on TV showing all these cars and planes and vehicles and things that he designed that they actually built into real things. And I was like, wow, yeah, I just really want to design things. And, at some point I went to do architecture. I went to Vancouver, to UBC, University of British Columbia.
And okay.
Talking to architects in Vancouver, they totally dissuaded me from going into architecture. And that was like a big wake-up call of, it's just very specific to Vancouver because there's tons of architects and not that many projects. So they were like, you're just going to get disillusioned. But one of my professors, in thermodynamics professor, Hill, his name, he found out about Art Center College of Design. And he said, yes. There's this design school, because I was in Canada, there was no undergrad design. you have to like graduate in engineering or something. You have to graduate from your university and then go to design school as, you know, like a master's or something.
Right.
And he's like, yeah, there's a school in Art Center, like you can go. And I finished my mechanical mm-hmm. engineering because I used to be in fine art in the first year. And I thought, you know what, I'm just doing art on the side anyway. It doesn't make sense to go to university to learn about fine art. I switched to mechanical engineering because I needed to know how things, I wanted to know how things work. Like if I design a car, how do I know how thick to make the I-beams and all that stuff? And I was a sponge. I was really thirsty.
Yep.
I was an artist first. So diving into engineering was like, you know, definitely, you know, what's the word? What's the term they put yourself in, you know, extend yourself into your comfort zone, out of your comfort zone. But I really wanted to face mm-hmm. the challenge and, you know, got through it and really learned a lot. And then ironically, every day in visual effects, I use that stuff. I mean, you know, right. every project I was on, I was like, oh yeah, I need physics for this. And I need that equation for that. And I need this for the shader. Yep. And everything involved some engineering. So that worked out, you know, Twister, Perfect Storm, all of these projects. The Pod Race had a lot of physics. So
yeah, of course,
you never know how you're going to apply what you're learning, you know?
Right.
And so that was, you know, a really great coincidence. So as much as painful as it was to put myself through it, I really pushed myself hard. And I was taking fine art electives for everything. You know, I was doing etching, silkscreen printing, there was a lot of hands-on art classes. I could at least keep that side going. And I was designing posters for the UBC sports program. So all those kept the art side going. But all throughout, I just wanted to, you know, get into visuals. And then when I went to Art Center, a lot of my instructors were actually designers for film. And there was Kurt Kaufman and Ed Eif. Ed Eif had designed the Rocketeer stuff. Kurt Kaufman's did Digimat work on a lot of films. And they said, you know, you're good with design. You should do design for film. Having seen things like, you know, Star Wars and Blade Runner, you know, I was totally into sci-fi. And I was like, oh, my God, if I could just, like, design for film, I don't have to worry about getting sued if the toaster kills someone. You know what I mean? On a real product, right? It's like it doesn't have to work. It just has to look nice. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, the whole conceptual part of like designing something from the future or something from a retro past, you know, whatever the case might be. And
sure.
And so, you know, those films really got my attention. And then that was right around 1990. I was about to, not to date myself, but I was about to graduate from, you know, I was about to graduate from Art Center. And that's, you know, after mm-hmm. I did UBC already in engineering. And, you know, there was like this project that came out. It was a movie. I was supposed to actually go to ILM as an intern. And they came and checked my work. And it's like, yeah, this is great. We're going to have you as an intern. And then as it turned out, they never got back. And I found out that Terminator 2 had taken up all their machines. So they said, oh yeah, we don't have enough machines for interns. But that summer I got a job on a film anyway, you know, Destiny, I guess. And then that movie was like everything I could learn about film. It was Adventures in Dinosaur City, became a Disney release. And it was film 101. I was on the actual set, walking out to Force Perspective miniature with dinosaurs in front. And you know, Rick Fichter was the DP and visual effects supervisor. And we, you know, we were inventing stuff. We have a lot of firsts on that movie people haven't heard of.
Right.
We did like inserting live action digitally into a matte painting. You know, it was all like, you know, Rick would come off the set and go, if I shoot this, would you guys be able to do that with it? You know? And we would think about it and be like, yeah, why not? You know, let's try it, you know? So it was a lot of figuring out how to scan film, how to output film. We were using his Mitchell camera frame by frame, shooting off the monitor, the SGR monitors. Lots of invention going on. Then I went back and finished Art Center for one more semester and went back into film with all the people I'd met, you know, on that movie. We connected, and we were using 486 computers with transputers and some RenderMan compliant software called Digital uh-huh. Arts. It was crazy times, but you know, I loved every second of it. And yeah. And it was, to me, it was like, hey, I can take my visual skills and the computer skills. And just to rewind a little bit, my brother worked at a company called Vertigo, and they were like a bleeding edge CG at the time. And they were known for character okay. animation, but they wanted some product design. My brother said, can you come design a car and build it in their software? You know, and my mind was blown because I've been good at imagining things in 3D in my head.
Yeah.
But this 3D software was showing me what was in my head, you know, and I'm watching it. And so I drew this car, you know, designed it, digitized the cross sections. And then they had this thing called lofting. It was a brand new invention that you could take these cross sections and get a surface. So I lofted these surfaces right. together, and lo and behold, I modeled the car and they showed it at SIGGRAPH. And that was my introduction wow. to computer graphics. And I loved it. I was like, you know, before that I was using airbrush and oil painting and, you know, all the hands-on art.
Yep. But
this was a whole new brush. And so having seen The Abyss,
and were you using Alias? Is that what you were doing,
yes.
Alias at the time? Or?
That's right.
Okay.
And having seen The Abyss, I was really hooked to like, oh my God, they use computers to do visual effects. You know, this is a game changer. Uh-huh. So I really pushed to get into that. And that's what we did with that Disney movie, was like, we did 3.5 minutes of CG, 58 shots. All of that's a record for the time,
right.
you know, because this is right after The Abyss, 1 year after The Abyss. And so, you know, it was great to try and figure things out. It was hilarious calling around, seeing if anyone can film record at 2K. Because the only thing that was around was
right.
these, I forgot the name of the Sinclairs or something. These machines that would film record, but they're meant for slides. You know, they're meant for single print. And here we were asking how much it would cost to do like, you know, 100 feet. So it was, the math wasn't right. You know, it was like, oh yeah, it's $10 a frame or something. And that whole thing is a whole nother story of like connecting with a guy who had film recorded Tron. And he had film recorded The Last Starfighter. Those were like big time early CG. And
right.
his name was Larry Sinclair, Lawrence
yes,
Sinclair.
Yes, of course.
And he was, you know, I was calling around like, what's resolution? Can you scan film? And everybody was like 2K, 4K, you know. So I called him, I got his number from somewhere, and he said 65K. And I almost fell off my chair. I'm like, excuse me, what? 65K resolution? He's like, yep. So he had built his own laser to scan and film record.
Right.
And I went to visit him. He was in the basement of CFI film with two Cray machines. And he had this silver sphere with a cylinder stuck on it and a wire. That was it. It's like, yeah, this is the laser scanner. And he pointed to these tapes,
wow.
these tapes all on a pole, sitting on a pole. And he points to them and he's like, that's Tron. That's the Tron data. Which I hope somebody
wow.
backed up, because that would be a shame. But, you know, it was, and he was smart. He charged by the megabyte. You know, that was the fee. It was like, I don't know what it was, how many dollars per half a meg.
Right.
So we were doing the math. We're like, okay, so it's directly related to what resolution we want. Ironically,
right.
the first thing he did was Yul Brynner vision, which was 250 pixels, like really square, sharp pixels across the screen for Westworld, the
right.
original movie. And so anyway, that whole project was an eye-opener. And then I started working in LA on IMAX movies for 2 years, and I got into ILM. And the first movie I worked
okay.
on was The Mask with Jim Carrey.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And ILM.
That's a good one.
Yeah. It was really fun. Steve Spaz Williams was animation supervisor.
Yeah, I know Steve. He's been on this podcast.
Yeah. So he's an awesome guy. You know, always thinking outside the box and funny and he's a character. So it was a you know, at the time I didn't know him, and he was like a very intimidating looking guy, and you know, he looked like like a Harley Davidson biker, and
still does.
Yeah, he's like, so they told me that like Spaz wants to meet you, and he at the time his office was in his basement in C building at the time in Kerner, and you had to go down this long flight of stairs to the basement, and I remember being terrified going down there, opening this door to this room that had no windows, and you know, of course Spaz is a sweetheart and it was amazing working with him, and then later I got to work with Stefan Fangmeier on many projects, lots of natural disasters, you know, Twister, Perfect Storm. I worked with John Nolan on two Star Treks and Star Wars Episode One. And, you know, it's always really about the people you work with. It's really, that's what was amazing.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. But those are some big shows. I mean, obviously Twister is well known, as well as Perfect Storm. And you got nominated for some Oscars, I believe, on those shows as well.
Yes. Right? So. And I won two BAFTAs. Very lucky.
And won two BAFTAs. Exactly. So yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And at the time the VES hadn't been formed yet. I was a founding member of the VES in 2000. It was, beginnings. It's great to have that.
Yes, 2000 was the first year of the VS. That's right. I remember that for sure. Yeah. I got into the industry in 2001. That was my first time in visual effects. So that's kind of where I started in that area. But yeah, that's really awesome. But those are some, you know, obviously some very important shows. And there were also things that were, you know, never done before, like big atmospheric stuff for Twister. I mean, that had never been done before. Perfect Storm had, you know, incredible fluid simulations at the time, was like a big, big deal. And still looks great even today. So those are really, really great shows.
Yeah, it's funny now I'm doing real-time water. We did that for Greyhound previs. Really, really, really cool, mind-blowing stuff. Work with NVIDIA on some real-time sims.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Now, you mentioned also, obviously, you said that, you know, Blade Runner was one of your, you know, things that inspired you, but you also worked on Blade Runner 2049. So with Paul Lambert, who I know very well, I used to work with Paul back in Digital Domain at the time. But
Paul is awesome.
What was that show like? Because it's gorgeous. Show, I absolutely love that movie.
That's definitely been a huge highlight of my whole career. John Nelson, visual effects supervisor on that, called me and to see if I can, you know, help them with some things, and the timing was perfect. And yeah, being a fan of the original, I was blown away by what I was seeing on the second one, and also I was a huge fan of Denis Villeneuve, the director. Arrival, and there's a French Canadian movie, Incendie, that he did. You know, so yeah, he was a perfect guy, perfect vision for the project, and his team is amazing. His team of editors, you know, Javier and Joe. There was like visual effects work on it, you know, to help just look at a ton of shots with John. There were seven facilities, you know, 1,400 shots, and we were getting, you know, 200-300 shots a day coming across from facilities, and we had to review them. So we were just, you know, locked in our editorial rooms, reviewing things, and you know, the work Paul's team did at DNA was amazing. Frame Stores, amazing stuff. UPP was involved. MPC in Montreal doing, you know, the recreations, digital humans.
Right.
And so there were so many different aspects the show was pushing. And then to top it off, we got to have Denis use this virtual camera tool that I was working on at the time that helps you film in real time. So we got him, you know, to operate and create the shots that needed, you know, specific camera work. And then, you know, those went straight into the film. That was an amazing combination. But just to be, you know, sitting.
Can you describe a little bit what those cameras looked like, or what, how that camera worked? Can you describe a little bit what it was?
So there was a number of shots that we had to rework, you know, either joining two shots that were separate or adding completely new shots, because the sequence felt like it needed more, like going from the Los Angeles to the orphanage. And Denise, editors Javier and Joe, had seen the real-time tools that I was, you know, I'd been using on other shows. We built tools for Jungle Book that Jon Favreau used, and then Ready Player One through Digital Domain to do all the real-time game engine stuff using the Unity game engine. And then the tools had evolved, and then at that point I'd left Microsoft and built our own tools. And so they saw the tools, and they saw, like, you could go anywhere in LA, attach yourself to the spinner and fly, you know, and just film, you know, be inside it, be outside it, or just pan, you know, have it fly across. And I just brought in the assets from Previs that MPC had built, and things come really easily into the engine, and you can just start filming. So in addition to all the visual effects supervision work, I just put these scenes together. And then Javier and Joe looked at it, and they're like, you know what, we should show Denis this tools. And, you know, so Joe's like, leave it to me, I'm going to show him what's possible. And then, you know, with Denis, things are, he's very decisive. It's either love or hate, you know, black and white. And so he said, one, you know, we would sit in John Nelson's office 2 hours a day reviewing stuff with Denis, that, you know, things that we'd seen from other facilities that needed his approval, or Roger Deakins' approval, he would be on the phone. And so he turned to me, he said, you know, I saw these tests you did, and I was bracing my, and I was holding on to the chair handle to see if he's like really angry about it or he liked it. And he said, it was very promising. Can we get together and shoot some of the scenes? So
nice.
That was amazing. And so we set some time and, did the camera work for, you know, a handful of shots really quickly. And he was like, yeah, this is it. I like, this is the camera move, you know?
Okay.
And so one of them was really cool. It was the spinner inside the trash mesa. And Kay is inside and he gets shot at.
Yep.
And then he starts, you know, he's supposed to gain altitude, go around the ship and fly over it and get harpooned. And that used to be two shots. And then he really wanted it as one fluid shot, but we never quite got that camera work and the spinner animation in the time frame that we had, because we were like a month from release. So, So then what I did was, I attached the spinner to the virtual camera, and he got to fly it by just pointing the camera, the virtual camera. So there's a sensor, and whatever he does with this virtual camera, the real camera does. But in this case, he's flying forward. So wherever he's pointing, he's going to end up flying. And so first he tried to do the motion we were trying to get, which is fly around this pylon and over the ship, and he kept crashing into the ship. It was too tight a turn.
Right.
And so he brings Joe over. Okay. At first, he's like, oh, I don't know if I can do this, you know, Habib, this is really hard. He brought Joe over, they looked at the cut, and then he said, well, you know, all that he would want to do at this point is he would want to gain altitude because he's getting shot at. So he altered the animation that goes in the scene. So instead of flying straight, going around and then over, he just gained altitude and went around a different pylon. And so we recorded that flight path. Right. And then I put him back inside the spinner, attached him inside, and then he hand performed the camera move. That shot's in the movie.
Right.
So you can see his point of view with the wipers going, and he's looking in front, gaining altitude. Then he looks to the lower left through the door, the window on the bottom, sees the ship go by, and that was the shot. And luckily I had those Trash Mesa assets from Framestore. It was like the high-res photogrammetry scans, but luckily, that worked out that we were able to just bring those in and run them in real time, and Denis knew right away he got the shot he wanted. The one where the spinner is flying along the seawall is another one, where the camera starts below and then it goes above and you see the ocean and the wall, and you also see the spaceship in the sky. That's a completely new shot that he completely shot himself freehand. And we had some camera smoothing built in. And then, that Paul's team rendered that a couple of weeks before release. We got really lucky that went in. And he was happy because they did some test screenings. And he said they felt there wasn't enough time from LA to the orphanage. It felt too short. Didn't feel like a trip.
Okay.
So that shot, also, he wanted to show the relationship between LA, the seawall, and the ocean, and the size of the spinner and the spaceship, all of these things you never saw together. There's other shots where we did a dolly. There's a dolly in Vegas that I did with Rich Hoover from Framestore. And then there's another one Denis did is the one of the Wallace Towers, the three concrete blades. There was a miniature shot of those that was which we were trying to make work best we could with John Nelson and I trying to change the lighting values on the different passes to see if we can get it to read, and it was very difficult from that angle. The spinner was passing by the camera and you just weren't sure what you're looking at because you hadn't seen it, and so with Denis, we location scouted this low angle that you see these towers, with a really wide lens. And so that became a combo where I was dollying and he was operating the camera head. So those shots, went in the film and I think they turned out really great. And you can kind of feel his, the handheld live aspect of it. It feels like a helicopter was really filming it. They helped give scale to the film.
Yep.
But, one of the techniques I came up with on that project, just out of necessity of time, was we would be seeing a ton of shots, and then both Denis and Roger Deakins would have a note on it about, let's say, the color of the detail in the sky. Or there'd be some note about something to do with I think it has something to do with, for example, how dark or light something is in frame. And these are things that would in the visual effect process, it takes time for a shot to go back to the artists. They get the notes, they work on it, it renders overnight. It gets composited, it gets sent back, we download it, we check it. The turnaround's difficult, right? Because there's a lot of rendering that has to happen. And so you're looking at anywhere from, 3 days to a week, 2 weeks to get a shot back. And there would always be like, Roger would say darker and it would come back and he would be like, no, I meant darker than that. No, I meant darker than that. So every note, you're like, you're losing a week. So John Nelson and I are like, we need to speed things up. I just started taking screenshots of the videos, of the video takes that we had, drop it into Photoshop, quickly mask off things, brighten them, darken them, just see what I can do. And then I had to like really quickly make a wedge. So I'd have a wedge of, let's say, usually 4 to 5 pieces. John and I would look at it and go, okay, here's a range of dark, on this, there was those giant trash ships, right, that are dumping trash. And I kept darkening the side, and also I had a wedge for smoothing the sky. Because one of the big things for both Roger and Denis was that the sky should have no detail in it. And for whatever reason, the artists love adding just some hint of some cloud detail, and they would be like, no, it's flat, you know? Right. So that was
songed in.
That's right. So quickly we would do the paint over, send it to Roger and Denis, or show it to Denis, send it to Roger. And then, they would just pick one. It would be A, B, C, D, E, F, right? And then Roger would be like, yeah, it's right. D, it's F, you know, that's the one. And then Denis would approve it. And then we had a visual target for how dark or how flat,
yeah.
you know, or how silhouetted or yeah. how whatever the note was. And so, you know,
right.
By the end of the project, I checked my folders. I had 500 Photoshop files.
Right.
Just yeah. from doing these reviews. And each file was all the wedges, right, in one file. And it's one of those,
right.
It just saved time. It helped communication. And it was, you know, it was just like a great way to, you know, find out exactly what they meant, you know, what they wanted in a quick way, right?
Sure.
Because it's really fast to iterate on just flat layers. And I myself was surprised, you know, how quickly one can just mask off things. You know, it sounds painful, but once you do a few of them, you're like, oh, this is 2 minutes, you know. And then at some point,
right.
The snow scene in the lab, the memory lab, outside the memory lab,
yep.
there used to be yep. these sculptures that actually okay. looked like Wallace the Wallace Towers in miniature. And
okay.
we, you know, Denis kept iterating on their size and placement, and you know, it was just a long process or over months. And finally that became one of the candidates for the paintovers, we call them. So I just grabbed the shot, grabbed these monuments and started to mess with their size and placement just in Photoshop. So it's like, you know, showing him a bunch of options. So we were wedging them and looking at those. And then, I'll never forget, this is one of my great memories. So Denis sitting there, and I started sensing what he wants or thinks at some point, you know, where he's commenting on shots. And I just started painting them out completely because one of the themes of the whole project was, Denis a minimalist. He's a, you know, he likes things to look simple. And
yep.
On a ton of shots, obviously us VFX artists, we love detail. We just love detailing out stuff. So these artists would just uh-huh. add a ton of detail, and he would just be like, no, remove this, paint this out. And so I knew that's what he was thinking. So I just started painting them out without saying anything. And he looks over at my laptop and he's like, you know, I'm afraid that's what we're going to have to do. You're on to, you know, he just had to, you know, we both were like, yeah, sadly, you just have to remove it.
Yep. We have to remove all the detail and all the design out of
yeah.
it.
Yeah. So that was,
I do have a couple of questions, especially about the feedback loop that you're getting. This is a really great to hear all of that. That stuff and understand that. But, you know, when you're dealing, you know, Villeneuve is obviously a fantastic director, and I can't wait to see what Dune turns out to be. I'm really excited about that.
Me too. Yeah.
But obviously Roger Deakins is a legendary, legendary DP and really knows what he's doing and communicating. But, you know, since he's been doing this for so long, what was it like to communicate with him? Did you feel that you weren't able to communicate fast enough to get his ideas out? Or like, you know, because obviously there's a lot of relationships that eventually will lead us to the conversation of virtual production and what that means.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering, like, right then in that moment, when you're dealing with Blade Runner 2049, what was that communication with him and how did you try to work with that in that area?
Yeah. Luckily, Roger loved the real-time stuff that came out of what Denis shot. He loved the look because we had a very even sky, even though it was real time fog,
yeah.
but you know, it was nice and even. But you know, I have to say, I've never seen a DP so involved in post. Typically, the DPs aren't, you know, in pre-production maybe, and then they're on the shoot.
Yeah.
And then everything's in the hands of just the VFX supes and the directors. And Roger was so incredibly involved, and he was so busy on color timing the film, he didn't have time to come to Sony where we were, even though we're both in LA. He was at eFilm at his facility, and he would call in, you know, on a conference call into our reviews, and what, you know, we would cinesync. But you know, when I started doing the paintovers, I would just email him and his wife, and they're a good team that worked together creatively, and they would both review things and send back the answer, you know, it's this one. And after you know, hearing his reviews and notes on shots, and you know, helping supervise them to happen with the visual effects facilities, you know, and doing the paintovers, I have to say, you know, because everybody says like he's Eagle Eye, that's his nickname, right? And it's absolutely true. It's absolutely true. The things he would notice and see were remarkable, and so his contribution to the visual effects and post was astounding. So he really, really deserved that DP Oscar on that project, because not only did he do all the craziness on set, which was you know, these massive banks of lights to get that fog in Vegas to look, you know, this orange fog, or you know, just the different scale of things, but he really saw it through, you know, and he was really consistent with his vision, just like Denis was. So both of them together, you know, really were amazing creative partners on that movie, and helped the vision, you know, and they really stuck to their guns. And so that was really amazing to work with Roger, and also be able to deploy the real-time tools and do this whole paintover thing, just to get things sped up, you know, and get them what they were looking for faster, you know, in a really crude 2D way, and then have that be a target, you know.
Right.
So I think those were the techniques.
It's really great. I mean, the work speaks for itself, honestly, and it's really nice, and I'm sure you know this, but as a visual effects person, when you have a DP actually contribute to the vision, you get it, it livens it up, and it feels better, generally speaking. I've had a couple of DPs that start to get in. Claudio was one of the people I worked with on Oblivion, and he was a little bit definitely more involved in color and timing and lighting. But it's always better than try to guess what the vision is, you know what I mean?
Very true. Very true. And they see things, you know, they had an intent when shooting something that we wouldn't necessarily know.
We're not privy to that.
That's right. One of the really interesting things was inside Wallace's building, where Rachel is, there's this, Roger built this rotating array of lights. And so these lights would rotate. You know, it would just keep spinning. So if you watch the scene, you'll see the light and shadow on Harrison Ford and Rachel is constantly moving. And it was just made it an even bigger challenge to do the digital. But, you know, on the wide shots, one of the visual effects shots was to put some, you know, some kind of science fiction looking spinning lights that are just spinning in the air, to justify that's where the light source is coming from, you know? And so we tried all kinds of combinations of what that looked like. And in the end, of course, we removed everything.
Of course.
Removed the detail, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Really, really great stuff. Now, you mentioned, obviously, real time. And, you know, you said that, you know, Jungle Book was what you'd worked on before Blade Runner. And I do want to understand where you get to Blade Runner. But was Jungle Book the first time that you really started to really dive deep into a virtual production thing? Or had you actually looked at real time and virtual production in a different capacity before then? When was sort of the first time you got involved in that?
I would say in Perfect Storm in the year 2000, we had the ocean simulations pre-calculated that would take something like a week to run on an SGI 32 processor tower. And then, but we would cache that data and I could play it through in real time on my SGI machine through Maya. We had a special plugin that Masi Oka wrote, you know, the actor.
Yeah, I do know him.
Heroes, yeah. So he wrote this plugin that would just take the water files, we call them, and bring them into Maya, and it would run in real time.
Right.
And then I created these ship simulations. That was a lot of fun. I was using the Maya rigid body system, so it was the rigid body in the shape of the hull of the ship. So it had all the correct moment of inertia that it needed. That part of Maya's rigid bodies are amazing. And then I basically had these markers that were basically depth sensors on the hull. So I put these locators around the hull, and I would check for depth along the ship to know how far below the water level is this part of the ship. And then all of these would get added into the fluid dynamic equations. I got some help from John Anderson, who wrote the big fluid sims. And then this would all run in real time.
Okay.
So the ocean playback and the ship simulation would run in playback in real time. And then
that's pretty good for 2000.
Not bad. Then we started constantly ending up underwater because these waves were like 50 feet, 70 foot waves. So you're trying to film another ship and you're just constantly underwater. And then someone, of course, says, I think it was Stefan Fangmeier, he's like, why don't we just put the camera on another simulated ship? Makes sense. Right. So now you're shooting ship to ship realistically. So then we had a camera boat, put a camera on that. So that ship's running dynamic simulation with physics. Then I had physics on the camera itself. The camera was also a rigid body. And then I gave it these points to look at with some physics equations to mimic human behavior. And it had literally these factors, these attributes on it called drunk factor and smart factor. And a human cinematographer is very drunk and very smart. Those are the parameters. And that, what that means is if you're trying to film something and it starts moving really quickly, you're not going to be able to follow it like an aim constraint. You're not a machine.
Right.
It's going to go out of frame. And then you're going to be like, oh, crap, I need to follow that. So you're smart, which means you catch up to it.
So right.
Between those parameters, we end up with these physics cameras that was simulating humans filming. But all I need to do is give it a target lookout point, and that point could animate or move. Say, look at the pilot house, now look at the front of the ship, you know. And so essentially we had these scenes where you placed the hero ship, you placed the camera ship, and you told it where to look, hit play, and you got a whole performance ship-to-ship shot that was really, really dynamic because everything is moving and the camera's trying to follow something, including the up and down of the sea. And that was that was my first taste of, you know, real-time virtual production. And what got better was we would have these satellite sessions. At the time, there was no Zoom or Skype. We had these $1,000 an hour satellite sessions. They were very expensive, but they were worth it. We had John Seal in Australia. We had Wolfgang Peterson, the director, in LA, and we were in the Bay Area. And they were directing me to position the ships, hit play, and get a shot.
Right.
And so we would place the sailboat or we place the Andrea Gale, position the camera ship, find a wave. You know, it was like we did have location scouting and it was all just waves. We like find a nice wave for what we're looking for, right? We're looking for a wave to just take over, or we need the backside, we're going towards them, away from them. You know, pick a wave height. We have all these buttons for these things. I had the most amazing Maya shelf, you know, with all the tools. You know, what ocean do you want? So we would basically set up the shot, hit play, and get a shot. You know, with feedback from the DP, John Seal. So that was also a case where the DP was really involved in post. And so, you know, going fast forward to Star Wars Episode One, we're doing the pod race. All the scenes outside the arena are all digital. And so these pods are flying and crashing at 800 miles an hour. We're actually going that speed in the software, which is amazing for floating point precision with physics.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we would basically crash a pod. So we got Mars pod, he gets the wrench in the engine, goes down. And these were all simulations running using the rigid body system. And I came up with ways to make them look like soft body deformation. imagine you take a whole bunch of bricks and connect them with chewing gum that doesn't let go.
Right.
So it's a solid frame, but if you hit a wall or hit the ground, it'll start deforming. The bricks don't change shape, but they start bending.
Right.
So it's like an airframe. I call it an airframe technique. So the pots would deform hitting the ground and start tumbling at that speed. We would put these giant invisible foam blocks for them to trip on. Because we needed to hit the ground and then start tumbling at a certain frame. So we put this invisible obstacles that you turn off. And it's sure enough, on the right frame, they would start tripping. One of the favorite shots was Sebulba Pod getting separated from his engine, you know, after he's locked with Anakin. And one of his engines goes flying like this. You know, one goes into a hill, the other one flies to his camera and goes over and above. That thing was using targeting physics. And I had a way to tell it where to aim. And then George Lucas was like, he wanted it to go off camera right. So if you watch that shot, you can really see it feels like an out of control, you know, rocket. And it's, you know, ends up going out of frame right. But that was all physics. John Knoll, who was the VFX super on that film, both him and I are big nerds when it came to physics. He was the one who came up with the idea of simulating the pods. And he had this 2D spring simulation, and he's like, look, we can make the pods feel realistic, you know? And I'll never forget, I took two cylinders in Maya. This is Maya Beta. It hasn't come out yet. Everybody's like, they're rigid bodies. We can't use them. It's, you know, they don't have ropes. And I at least my engineering background, I was like, well, you just take some cylinders, pin them together, and you have a rope. So that was the that was the system for the pods following the engines. But we took two engines and connected them with these springs. So there was four springs across and four diagonal. And John and I are watching the monitor. We hit play, and these two cylinders just start going. They just go like this, affecting each other like you wouldn't believe it. And just that, just the idle physics. Him and I were, our jaws were on the ground. We're like, oh my God, this is the way we have to do it.
So that's the way to go.
Every pod shot is a rigid body simulation.
That's amazing. That's really cool. But, yeah, really,
you know,
really
the
cool.
Animators would basically puppeteer where they should go. Then the physics would take over all the little bits and pieces. But
What
got me to talk about that? Oh yeah, virtual production.
Exactly.
So Star Wars was another one where we would do these simulations of these pod crashes and then film all the shots. So it was like one animation and then we would film it. And we had plans of like flying the pods with joysticks like it's a real time game, but we never got to that.
Yeah. But when you did Jungle Book, obviously that was a big jump in virtual production. You had cameras and everything else, and you had one live action character, and everything else had to be seen in real time to filmed in real time. So, what was that transition like? What was that project like when you were working on that?
It was really magical to see that on set, and I wish Disney would at some point release some of the behind the scenes because it really was history in the making. We had, you know, Bill Pope, the DP, moving the lights in real time, filming shots with all the virtual lighting in it. And then you had these actors becoming animals. It's 14 actors became 7 wolves seamlessly. You could swear you're looking at wolves being mocapped.
Right.
And then, you know, he could just direct them and have them perform a different performance or look in a different way and film them, cut it all together, see if it works. You know, tweak shots that need tweaking or reshoot some shots. But, you know, we started that work in 2010 when I was at Microsoft. And we used the Unity 3.5 engine and we customized the rendering. We totally added all the features that we needed for HDR buffers. We had high dynamic range rendering, depth of field bokeh, LUTs, lookups, you name it, you know, linear lighting, all of this stuff we were able to put in. I had a fantastic team that worked on that. I had John Habel, who's the master of any gamma correct lighting in real time engines, doing the HDR linear lighting and the bokeh depth of field. And then Wes Potter, who I partnered with afterwards to do Exposure, which was the newer version. The team was able to put the tools together. At the time, we did a demo to James Cameron with their assets, and Joe Letterio was there. You know, they were really happy with the results, and that kind of became, that was in 2010.
Okay.
February 2011, we did the demo. That became a really positive step for the direction they wanted to go in. They ended up building their own tools that were real time. But, you know, watching Jim use the tools and, you know, really enjoy the process of shooting and having all the things that he wanted to be addressed, we were able to hit them all. You know, there was 2 frames of lag instead of 7 or 10. He could compose in real time, and we were using the actual high-res models from Weta, the full-res,
right?
Jake and Neytiri, and so that was a really magical demo. I wish I had more footage of it, but basically, that was the beginning of knowing what we have. But then it took many years for that to actually be deployed on a project. In 2012, we were partnering with Alex McDowell, the production designer. He's a visionary, and he really got the virtual production.
He's been on this podcast. I know Alex as well.
Yeah. He's a remarkable guy, and it was tremendous to work with him. And we worked with him on Disney's Order of Seven in 2012. Okay. That's when we realized the power of these tools aren't just faster, better looking. It was actually a game changer for communication across the board with people working on a project and changing the results. Just like what Denis experienced when he performed the shot and decided to change what should happen in the shot. It's the same kind of thing, but multiplied by every single person who's involved creatively. And so both Alex and I were surprised at that discovery. We didn't actually anticipate that it would be that, you know, how far reaching those could be. And producers would come up, and we had the set running in real time on a big TV. So whenever they wanted to come, they could interact with it. And it was really amazing to see people's reaction and what they would go back and change. And so a Jungle Book around 2013, also starting with Alex McDowell, he was initially the production designer on that. And then he had to do more work on the USC side. You know, he was a professor. But basically, he got us doing a demo for Rob Legato at Digital Domain, and he put us through the paces, you know. And he liked what he saw, and he's like, yeah, this is what we want to use. And so, you know, we continued developing and honing those tools through the project. At the time, we were streaming from Motion Builder into Unity. And so tools really focused around all the interfaces for that, and lighting tools, and all the things that needed to be real time on set. It was really incredible and magical on set to watch, you know, Jon Favreau, Rob, you know, and Bill Pope doing their thing. And I really hope one day you get to see, or people get to see that.
You know,
and it was a big first.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It was a very important film, I think, in a lot of ways, because of the workflow that was happening and filmmaking. And, you know, obviously there's been incremental stuff that happened, as you mentioned before, in terms of virtual production. But that was one of the films that's like, no, we're going to do a lot. Like, it's going to be all filmed in other ways. And I think that those are great, great moments. And I think that was also very important. It's also the moment when game engines started to really come into play into the world, because, you know, I think that much we could do with Motion Builder, you know, Motion Builder has
been,
and it was finally the game engines like, well, we could help you. We can be involved in Jungle Book, and even actually in Lion King and some other things that were done. It was really kind of a part of the Unity team. Am I right in saying that?
Through Jungle Book and Ready Player One, those were just my team working with the latest Unity we could get and do all the virtual production work as plugins. By the time we got to Ready Player One, that was Unity 5.4. And so they'd added a few rendering features so that we didn't have to include. But I remember showing up on set and helping Girish at the time was the VCam room operator. There was the live on stage, and then there's the VCam room where Spielberg would compose, you know, would shoot shots that they recorded to do extra camera work on it. And so I showed up to help him get some new features like volumetric lighting and other plugins. But, you know, that project was really pushing the volume of stuff. There was like, I think they prepared like 2,000 scenes, you know, and 600 weren't used. But, you know, they were able to, you know, that was a perfect project for virtual production because everything's in VR. So the actors, Steven, the production designer, could all be in VR looking at the sets. I know Adam Stockhausen, the production designer, used VR to design them. So we, you know, Digital Domain gave him basically a mini setup of our tools so he could look in there. Digital Domain did a lot of the VR tools on that project for the VR filming side. And then we were doing all the live on set, you know, pushing through from Motion Blur into Unity. And on that project, the communication became two-way. So we added, I think Wes Potter was and John Wheeler were programming. So you could actually move something in Motion Builder or Maya and see it move in Unity, or you could move it in Unity and they would move in the other two. And it didn't matter which one you used. And so the power, and this is what we
said. All live linked, basically.
That's right. And the power of what we started doing, even for Jungle Book, was that you can have 10 artists operating on the same scene, which is necessary on these big projects where you have, you know, time is money and you want things done immediately. So then you don't have the bottleneck of one artist, you know, and what they could do. And so I know Steven appreciated that and he was able to really harness it even more and more throughout the project. And so between those two, those really pushed the tools, you know, to a really good place. And, you know, at that point, I think those are the only two big projects using game engines on set. After that, you know, I think obviously we've come a long way now with many, many projects between all the engines now getting into it. But it's really great to see the industry, you know, getting a lot more mature about it. You know, it was frustrating to have these tools and you do a demo and people are like, I don't know, what is this? Like, what are we, you know, they didn't know what they're looking at. So like we had this since 2010.
Yeah.
You know, and it took, you know, it took 3 years to find a project that could totally use it. And then, you know, even now just people are finally seeing things and hearing about other, you know, LED screens and all the things that are happening, and it's starting to click, which is great, you know. And so that's a big part, because you'll still have people that you know, they'll say, you know, there's directors that'll say, oh, I don't believe in previs, you know, well, what's that for, how does it benefit me? Or producers that say, how do I save money, it's going to cost me to do previs, how does that save me money? So, you know, like, we know as a fact how it's contributed, you know, on every show. But it has to, I don't know, you need like, you almost need two groups of people to do the exact same movie two different ways and compare notes later. I don't know. It should be soon, hopefully, it should be a no-brainer.
Yeah, you know, I think virtual production is definitely the way to go. And a lot of different things that are happening in that area, and I really find it fascinating. I would love to know more about you know, where you think things are going. So if you have other projects that are coming up that we can look into, you know, what is there something we can look at you know, look to and say, okay, that's interesting. What's happening in the future of virtual production?
Yes, there's a bunch. Absolutely, yeah. I'm working on one right now.
Okay,
several, yeah. Yeah, it's very exciting. And, you know, the current situation in the world has pushed that to, you know, accelerate even more as a necessity.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure, sure. Well, that's awesome. So we'll look forward to seeing those. And I really, you know, I'm going to thank Colin again for doing the introduction and getting us together. But there's a lot of great stuff. And I really appreciate, you know, sort of hearing that history of what led one to the other. And the deep dive into Blade Runner 2049 was a an amazing story. I really appreciate that as well. So yeah, this has been really great. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thanks. It's great to meet you and you know, go down the memory lane on these really cool projects.
Yeah, for sure.
Let's do it more.
All right. Thanks so much, Habib. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Chris.